Well, we're now down in the Pinetum and under these impressive trees, and I think, as somebody has just pointed out, it has a little bit of an environment of its own. It's a very secluded spot in a sense, a quiet place, and I'm assured by one of our earlier staff that it's not been unknown for people to sunbathe in the nude down in this little dell. I've got no confirmation of that myself, I regret to say.
I thought you'd be right on.
Anyway, I'm interested in the horticultural content here. And you're looking around, you'll see the different character of the various pine species from many parts of the world. And in front of us here is Magnolia campbelli, in a very protected spot. And if you happen to come down in June to do some sunbathing down here, you will find that that will be in full flower, and a magnificent tree because it's so protected from wind.
Tree of the body.
It's one of the... Sorry?
The tree of the body.
Oops-a-daisy, we're getting into deep water here again. The other place you will see them is down in the valley of the Huatoki, just upstream from Powderham Street, beside the radio station. There are some beautiful magnolia campbellis there, and of course they're so significant because they flower right in the middle of the winter with these great big flowers. And you see here again we're surrounded by native bushes, the foil behind, except for those poplars there, and that used to be a favourite spot for possums. I came down here one night and I counted, oh now how many was it, put a spotlight on those trees and there were just simply dozens of opossums in them. A bit high to shoot too, incidentally. So now we will travel from this little dell further down into the floor of the Maranui Gully. Right, now we've come from the Pinetum at the corner of the Brooklands Bowl lawn across the little stream that comes down through the Maranui Gully, and we're standing on the main path from the Bowl of Brooklands which carries on up the valley to up John Street. We've come across this little stream here, and this is where I think we ought to really have some of these little detention dams, you know, to hold water going down towards Pukekura Park. There are several places where paths cross the stream. This is one of the main sources of water to the Pukekura Park lakes. And these could be developed as detention dams, I think, to hold back a little bit of water. Anyway, I'll terminate this. This is tape two, side one, of the walk through Brooklands Park being conducted by the Friends of the Park. George Fuller is my name, as the person taking the group for the walk through, and the recording is being made for the oral history section of the Taranaki Museum. We are now down in the Maranui Gully, having just crossed the stream from the Pinetum on the Brooklands Park side of the valley, and we are about 75 metres from the turning circle at the Bowl of Brooklands. We're now going to walk a little bit down towards the Bowl of Brooklands because there's a small sidetrack there that I want to show everyone, where there are some very unusual and interesting puriri trees. Okay. Now we're about 30 metres up the path into the Maranui Gully from the boundary fence of the Bowl of Brooklands, and at this point there's a little track, pretty obscured track, going in to the left. Incidentally, I meant to check up on the maps, maybe it's on Heather's map, but these paths here behind the bowl, and I think this one here has a connection with the boys' high school, because in the formative days of the bowl, I think it was, and certainly later in my time in the 1960s and early 70s, we had great assistance from the boys' high school in forming these paths. I'll go on a little bit more about that as we go up this path towards, you know, further up the Maranui Gully towards up John Street. But at this point here, 30 metres in, we have this little side track, which I certainly had assistance from in upgrading from the boys' high school. I'm taking you up here to show you some pereries, which are of some interest. It won't hold in, the switch won't hold. We're having a little bit of trouble on the switch on the tape recorder. It's not performing as I expected it would do. But however, we are going now. Now, up this little path, about 50 metres, as I say, it's a pretty obscured sort of a path, not easy to see, but when I was curator, I had this cleared up, and it makes actually a circuit walk at the top here. You'll see there's an orienteering sign, number 25 there. And so it does appear on some of the maps. I'm not sure, it'll probably be on your map. Yes, it is on the map that Heather's using to identify our movements. And the first group of pereri that I wanted to show you is this group of what are about five or six, maybe seven trunks that all come with us from ground level within about 2 or 3 metres of each other and go up and spread into a big canopy of what, 25 metres or so, which is the normal canopy for Puriri, Pukatia, Koikoi, Titoki that are common in this area. The trees that will go through that canopy would be Kaikatea and Riwariwa and Tawa. Anyway, can anybody tell me whether we're looking at one tree here or six or five or four or what?
It could have come up all from the really high trees.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult to say. Anyway, whatever one's assessment of the situation, probably be only determined by DNA samples, I think. It's certainly a very unusual group. But the tree I particularly want to see, or to show you, rather, is this big giant above our heads here. This is an absolute monster. And I'm not sure whether it's one tree or two. The upper part of it, and then we're now looking in a southerly direction from 50 metres up this track. We're looking up towards the racecourse stabling area. There is what one would regard as a relatively typical puriri going upright. It's got a very big base on it, but coming from ground level out over our heads and at an angle of what, 45 degrees or something, is a massive trunk which must weigh tons and tons and tons. Total overhang, very, very big trunk. But that's one thing in itself. Just try to imagine when it rains how much weight there is in that trunk with all those great epiphytes, great clumps of epiphytes. I mean, it's got an even exceptional loading of epiphytes on it, which must weigh hundreds of kilos when... they themselves, just the epiphytes, would weigh hundreds of kilos when it rains. But the other fascinating thing about this, which I've never been able to understand, is if you go up to the trunk as I am now, it splits into two like a big pair of trousers. And you can stand, there's a big gap in the lowest 2 metres, 3 metres of the trunk, which is, again, remember, total overhang. There's a massive gap in here which you could climb through. And it actually has two distinctive trunks. Now, you'd assume that they were roots since they separate in that way. You have to come up to have a look at it to see how unique it is. So you can walk down through here. So I've, with my plant knowledge, I've tried to figure out how this could possibly happen, and I can't find an explanation for it. So a very spectacular tree in any sense of the word, but particularly unusual because of this strange structure at the base. Now we're just coming back from the Pereries towards the Maranui Gully track, and I've stopped at this bunch of superjack because there's a very interesting characteristic here which probably not many people have thought about. This looks like absolute chaos and pandemonium here, doesn't it? All these great strands of superjack going up into the trees. But if you notice, every single one of them is climbing the same way. What they call a helix is constant throughout. And if you wanted to put it in engineering terms, Gordon, it's a right-hand threaded plant. Where is he? Oh, Gordon's gone, sorry. Yeah. In other words, if you stood above it and looked down upon it and you wanted to thread something onto it, you would turn it in a clockwise direction, a right-hand thread. Other plants will be, so to speak, left-hand thread. The helix will go in the opposite direction. But if anybody ever sees another one that's different, please let me know. But I have never, ever seen one that goes in the opposite direction. Now, you'll see what it means. When they touch each other, they wind up. And there are literally ropes there. You know, there's one in front of us there with probably 15 strands all going up in the one strong, what would you call it, rope, I suppose. So just a bit of useless information for you. We've now travelled, how far are we from Bowler Brooklyn's boundary? About 150 metres up the Maranui Gully, travelling roughly south. And on the left-hand side of the path, we've stopped at a rather large specimen of the native Pukatea, or Laurelia novozelandiae, which suggests that it could be something related to laurel, isn't it? Now, we're looking at this tree because of its remarkable roots. Pukatea is one of its great attributes, is it will grow in very swampy ground, as indeed we are standing in at the moment. And it's able to virtually lift itself out of the swampy ground by these incredible sort of palisade-type roots, which in some cases can be, let me see, we've got one there that's about nearly a metre deep, and it's only about 15 centimetres wide. So very flat roots in the sense that they sort of go out from the tree, are very narrow and very deep. And you'll see that it's this is so that the roots of the tree can breathe. That's its system of coping with the lack of oxygen that there would be in the swampy ground beneath us here.
It heaps Pukatea on the ground.
Yes, there's many seedlings coming up. It has a windborne seed, and there'll be absolutely thousands of them through this valley, these young seedlings of Pukatea. And do you know what that is? We've been looking at that already. That's that orange seed of the koikoi.
Oh.
So somewhere around about here, there is...
like a berry.
Yeah, this is only the actual seed. The fruit is round like a sort of a green walnut.
Take any seeds home.
So that's one example of a tree being able to adapt to a very, very wet root situation. Now we're further up the Maranui Gully, we've just crossed a little culvert which I mentioned formed by, as far as I can remember, we used tantalised cowrie beams on that, which would be pretty unusual use for cowrie in this modern day and age. Cowrie does take tantalising, so that was one of the means of preserving it, because it wouldn't stay underground otherwise. And I stopped at this part of the path. I think we're probably about 50 metres from the intersection coming down from the Big Koorari at Brooklands and near the Ginkgo, and where the little sidetrack goes off to the Ginkgo, about 50 metres north of that towards Brooklands Bowl. And I stopped you here because this is where we can be really grateful for assistance from boys' high school pupils. Many of you remember that, certainly the males, that in days gone by there used to be cadet services in the high schools. And it's strange to think in this day and age, when just recently we've had so many attacks with almost massacres in schools, that when we were at high school, people of my generation, we were actually taught at high school how to use firearms in the military drills that we did. So times do change, don't they, after the Littleton disasters in the United States a couple of weeks ago. When they were starting to get a bit fed up with the idea of military training, they turned the effort into community service, and that gave parks departments, where they could organise it, a good resource of labour. And in the 60s, early 70s probably, this path would not have been negotiable except in gumboots at this time of the year. It was absolutely sodden. And with the help from the numbers, the labour intensity, the labour force of the boys' high school students, we were able to raise it quite considerably, probably half a metre. We had to make little quarries into the side of the bank here to scavenge enough material to form up these paths. And now, of course, since then has been the tremendous advent of jogging and walking and all that sort of stuff. It was so important as a consequence of that coming about that these paths be upgraded. So there's a contribution from high school students. They probably thought they were being pretty hard done to at the time, although they were very willing in most cases. But they can come back here now and say, well, we had something to do with transforming this place from a swamp into such a lovely attraction. And we've walked up, you could walk up here in ballroom slippers, really, in a way, and wouldn't be upset by the conditions. But believe me, it was a gumboot trail in the 1960s. Now we've just passed over the second culvert and come out of that area where the Boys High School had put in such a lot of physical effort, and we're at the first intersection of a pathway going off to the left up towards the racecourse, or the top end of the racecourse. We passed a couple of these little quarries that yielded the soil. And we're almost at the intersection where the pathway goes up to the Big Pereire at Brooklands. And I stopped here because this is one of those areas which we take for granted these days. But this was another private property, not in any way associated with Brooklands at all, although now it would be regarded as a part of Brooklands Park. This is the back portion of the property owned by, I think it was C.T. List, who was, I think in his day, editor of probably the Herald, might have been the proprietor. Anyway, he was associated with newspapers as a profession, and his garden was equally as famous in some ways as the King's Garden, as Brooklands, and they adjoined each other. And we'll talk about that boundary. It has a little bit of fun significance later. But what I want you to see here is now we've come across rhododendrons and a big beech tree, copper beech up there. And it's so out of character with all that bush-like growth that we've come through. And the reason is that it was a very, very highly organised garden. And these terraces up towards the Brooklands Park side were, and we can still see the remnants of some of them, were planted with rhododendrons and so on. It was a very beautiful garden. And some of you will remember George Huffman's, who subsequently had the rhododendron nursery up Carrington Road. He's a very keen rhododendron man and a great propagator. I believe he was the last gardener employed by List. So there's a personal link. I knew George well, and he was at Duncan and Davies at one stage. At one stage he was in the ferneries at Poikura Park, I believe. But anyway, he was, if my memory serves me correctly, the last gardener that List had. Now, C.T. List, I believe, again, relying on my memory, I think he began the New Plymouth Beautifying Society. So you can see he had a lot of connection with gardening and horticulture. Sorry?
He'll be a young woman. Beautifying Society.
Oh, beautifying, yeah. I think he was talking about plants.
George, yeah. When did List? Did he donate his property to the council?
Yeah, now this is the point that in 1933, when the Brooklands property was vested in the care of the council, so indeed was this property, and his property was called Maranui, I understand, and it comes in from Maranui, you know, the homestead is up on, and it's still there with massive phoenix palm up on above us towards the east there. It was
geologist Sheldon, isn't it?
He lives there now, does he? McAlpine, yeah, could be. Anyway, and then there was this property of Wilkinson too, which I think might have been further up towards Highland School. But you can see how important they are to this whole area.
Not
you know, very well known. And not well known.
Exactly.
Get away. Oh, dear me. Now, this is what I brought you up to see. As we look up towards List Street, look at the gold coming through the trees. Now, this is where this little loop track goes in up towards List Street, and that is the shagbark hickory that I particularly brought you up to see today, because that will be one of the most magnificent autumn trees. There's a little loop track here that we'll take. And I meant to mention, just as we came up through this last section, you'll notice that there were quite a number of eucalyptus trees which had fallen. And that was because they'd grown up in very unstable and wet ground, not ground suited to eucalyptus. We're just now on this little loop walk going up through some very large eucalyptus. And
it's male, isn't it, George?
Ian Berry's just found a male eucalyptus. I don't think we're going to the details of that. Yes, what were we saying? Oh, yes, they're growing on higher ground, and you'll see they haven't blown over, as indeed the other ones had. So we'll do this little loop track in towards the old ginkgo and the shagbark hickory, and not a murmur from you. Right, now we're in the top end of this little loop, which is only really, 50 metres from the main track up through the Maranui Gully. And we're standing below an absolutely magnificent sight. The shagbark hickory is at its very best at the moment, and we haven't got the sun on it, unfortunately, but even so, it's just a brilliant golden yellow and a very large tree. I have measured its height in the past, and I can't remember what it is, but it would probably be 20 metres high, nearly. And just a blaze of golden yellow. beneath it there are dozens of the fruits. They are of the walnut family, and they do germinate. It's just such a pity that there aren't more of this species in the New Plymouth area. No, that's a strange point. I don't. We've got these hundreds and hundreds of fruits around us, and there's not a single young plant of this anywhere in sight. In fact, I don't know of many plants of it, even young ones. There are some young ones about now, but it hasn't been more widely planted because you just couldn't get the plants of the species.
Where does it come from, George?
It's North American, and I'm desperately treading water trying to remember what its name is. It's written on the... I didn't send this guy over to give me the name of it because he'll come back with something. Probably unrecordable, but we'll be passing the name on its trunk in a minute. But the other tree I want you to see here is this big one in front of us, the ginkgo biloba. Now, that's the maiden hair tree of China, found generally in temple grounds there. When List, many years ago, had a visit from a... they had a Rotary conference, I think, in New Plymouth, and he was visited by a notable Chinese person who... and he must have stayed with List up in their residence up on the height there. And apparently each morning he used to come and pray under this ginkgo tree because it was a tree associated with prayer and that in China where he came from. It's probably the biggest specimen of ginkgo biloba, certainly in Taranaki and probably farther afield. And up until a few years ago, there were three trunks of equal size, all branching, as you see, from the base. And because of the nature of each trunk expanding in diameter, the third trunk one day just got separated, just fell off. And so the whole tree is under threat because those two that are left will continue to react against each other in exactly the same way. Now, it's interesting that we're in, the early part of May, and it's still totally green, whereas beside it we have this hickory in full autumn colour. The ginkgo does also have wonderful autumn colour, but it doesn't come until June. And yet, if you go into the Truby King Dell, where I said those wonderful liquid ambers are, you'll find that there are two ginkgos down there. One as green as this one, and the other one, the leaves have actually gone. It's finished already. So, you know, it's strange.
A lot of epiphytes.
Yes, this one does bear a lot of epiphytes. And there's one thing about ginkgo biloba. It produces fruits which hang rather like plain fruits. They hang on a stem a few centimetres long, and they're very much sought after in China as a medicinal thing, I think. Yeah, so the Chinese transform everything into medicinal. But what I can't understand about this is if you had one of these in the house, it would just about drive you out with the dreadful smell that the fruit has. It literally stinks. But, you know, it seems to be... much sought after as a fruit in China. How old? I really don't know. It would relate to List's residence here. And there is a label I see on the other side.
It doesn't go around.
Well, did you find the name of it? I'm going to walk over. Now, don't tell me. I'm going to walk over and breed it myself. Kindness radiata, yeah. Yeah, Carrier alba. Carrier alba, that's the hickory.
That's not very good.
From North America. No, there's nothing we could be upset about over there. Planted in the... we're going over now to the ginkgo biloba, the maidenhair tree. It's from China, doesn't say that there, but it's planted in the 1880s by Mr. Clement Gavett. Now, Gavett was the owner of the property up here before List.
Oh,
he preceded List, apparently. So, again, we're going into that great era of the 1870s and 1880s when so many plants were put in Taranaki. Now we're back off that little loop into the Maranui Gully on the main path going through, and we're now just going to cross over the bridge, which takes us back into the Brooklands side of the gully. Further on up, we have an access route to List Street, and on the Brooklyn side of the gully, a track that goes up to Upjohn Street. Now we're now in the dell and can see the terraces where List up on the Brooklyn side. We can actually see the terraces which were the pride and joy of List's garden, where he had the rhododendrons.
And,
well, somebody just asked where his property ends. I'm going to mention that because it forms the basis of a good story. It's up on the ridge, closer to the Puriri tree up on the heights of Brooklands Park. We'll talk about that when we get up there. We're going up in that direction now, returning to sort of Brooklands Park in the area of the large Puriri.